yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions, where we discuss what's going on in the grassroots and not just talking heads on cable TV. Okay, today we're going to turn back to our series that we've been having over the past 6 months of looking at the question of has American labor reached a strategic dead end? A strategic impasse. In other words, are the strategies of union labor, when I say American labor here, I'm going to talk about that segment called union labor, an ever-shrinking segment, and has the strategy that it's been employing for the last several decades pretty much reached an impasse. In other words, no longer producing any positive results. And in fact, perhaps producing negative results. And by strategy, I mean not just political strategy, which in its essence is aligning with the Democratic Party, but also its industrial strategy. In other words, bargaining. Its bargaining strategy. This focus, which is called maintenance of benefits. In other words, let's give up some wages here. Let's just hold on to our health care and our pensions. And let's trade off wages for that because we're not able to get very much in terms of wage increases out of employers anymore, and that's a fact. So let's just focus on benefits, maintaining our benefits, mostly health care and pensions. Of course, employers prefer to go that route because they can, whatever they pay in benefit increases, they can then deduct off of their taxes to the government. So they'd rather give benefit compensation increases than wages, which they can't deduct. But what we see today is the end of that whole strategy, maintenance of benefits, on the industrial level, simply because they're taking away pensions, taking them back, and in 2018, we will have a collapse of employer union negotiated health care plans as a result of Obamacare, because those plans will be hit with a 40% excise tax, and that will be the end of that. And all people on union plans will have to go on the exchanges and buy subpar benefit programs at a higher cost, like everybody else is. Okay, so what's wrong with the industrial strategy in terms of bargaining, but also industrial in terms of problems with strike strategy and tactics, and problems with organizing? So that's what we mean when we say at a strategic impasse. And we've been interviewing a number of very experienced people on this topic, Ray Rogers and Greg Shotwell, and folks who have had a lot of experience in the labor movement. And my guest today is a continuation of that trend. His name is Staunton Lynn. You may have heard of him. He's been around for some time, and in this series we want to talk with people who've been around for some time, who have seen days when union labor was much more successful. Yours truly, having been an organizer and local union officer, negotiator, strike leader in the 1970s, I saw a day when labor was much more successful and much more aggressive than it is today. Folks don't realize that in the 1970-71 strike wave, for example, the second biggest strike wave in U.S. history, union workers were getting wage and benefit increases of 20% in the first year of a three-year contract. 20%. Can you imagine out there getting a 20% raise today? You're lucky if you get a 2%. You're lucky if you can prevent them from cutting it by 2%. But there was a day when labor was able to do that. Well, that was quite some time ago. And we are in a total different world now, particularly since the late 70s and then the 80s with Ronald Reagan and his clones, Reagan clones, in the form of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And, of course, George W. Bush, who is Reagan on steroids as far as it taking money back from working folks is concerned and giving tax cuts to the rich. Although I think Obama may be overdoing him here, having given even more tax cuts to corporations and wealthy investors than even George W. Bush. But that's another topic. Well, anyway, today I want to interview George Staunton Lynn. Staunton, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Staunton has such a long bio here of great contributions to critical analysis as a historian and in the labor movement, participating and so forth, that I'm just going to refer folks to the website here if they want to see Staunton's magnificent contribution over the history of his life to progressive movements here. Staunton is probably best known for his historical writing, however, and he has a new book coming out, and we want to talk part about that book called Doing History from the Bottom Up. I love that title, Bottom Up, because that's where we have to start all over, from the bottom up. We need movements, and of course they are appearing, these movements today, but they're all running off in different directions. And they're all about single-issue politics, and you know my view about that. The bane of progressive movements in America today is single-issue politics. And someday we need to get these real movements from below with real leaders together in a national convention and form a new political party. And I know some of you who have anarchist leanings out there don't like the idea of a political party, but my view is, folks, there's just no easy way. That has to occur, and we have to contend for power in the institutions of this country. And yes, there are problems with that, but we have to deal with those problems, and that if we do not do that, we are already divided, which is two-thirds of the road to Concord. So anyway, I like the bottom-up approach here, the title of your book, Staunton. And I believe it's also reviewing some of the great contributions by E.P. Thompson and Howard Zinn and others about rebuilding the labor movement from below. So I believe this book is coming out soon. Can you tell us some details about the book? And then let's just jump into your views on this question of is union labor in America at a strategic impasse?
As far as the book is concerned, it will be published by Haymarket Books in Chicago. We're shooting for November 2014, less than a year away. And as you suggested, Jack, the last 60% of the book is a description of how I came to form my present analysis of what's wrong with the labor movement. And I did it not by simply sitting in a library and reading pieces of paper, but as a historian and a lawyer doing oral histories, trying to help people when the mills closed. And I thought that it was the most substantial contribution that I've made, and that's why most of the book deals with it.
Well, wonderful. Well, we're going to get to that. Could you tell us a little bit more about how the book looks at some of these other contributors to U.S. Labor history, or Thompson? I guess he's not American, as I understand.
Well, let me do it this way. Some people in your listenership will remember that toward the end of the 1960s, many young people in the New Left were beginning to say, in the last analysis, social change depends on labor. And so they were taking jobs in steel mills and automobile assembly plants, wondering, you know, how to be useful in that way. And it just so happened that my wife and I were given the opportunity of interviewing, doing oral histories, with a series of men and women who had done the same thing in the 1930s, who helped to build the CIO. And so our initial idea was, well, if these kids are trying it again, perhaps we can help them do it more effectively by drawing on the experience of the people who did it a generation ahead of them. And so in the course of doing that, we sat in the same room with an amazing group of folks. And if I had to single out one, it would be a man named John Sargent, S-A-R-G-E-N-T, who was the first president of the Steelworkers Organizing Committee at Inland Steel, a major steel facility on the shore of Lake Michigan, south of Chicago. And John, I could have fallen off my chair when I heard him, because he said, "Sutton, I'm here to tell you that we had more power over wages and benefits before the steel workers union was recognized as an exclusive bargaining agent at Inland Steel," which happened during World War II. And I said, "How can that be, John?" And he said, "Well, the key to everything is the right to strike." Because what folks didn't realize at the time was that, yes, the company would recognize that, but there was a price to be paid, and the price to be paid was two clauses that you'll find in, I dare say, any CIO contract that anyone in your audience is familiar with. The first is the so-called management prerogatives clause, which gives the company the right to make all decisions about investment. Sorry, Jim and Dick and Harry, but we're going to close the plant a month from now. CIO contracts give the company the exclusive right to make such decisions. And at the same time, the typical CIO contract from the very beginning took away from ordinary union members, the kind of folks you represented in your local union, the ability to do anything about those decisions by stopping work. In other words, you find me a CIO contract that doesn't contain a no-strike clause, and I'm going to be very interested, because the typical contract gave the company the right to make the big management decisions and took away from workers the ability to do anything about those decisions through direct action.
Well, prescient comments there, Scott, and I absolutely agree with you. Having negotiated decades ago, of course not in recent decades, scores of contracts, it was always required, or management would go to a lockout or a strike without the management's rights clause. That was even more important than even the work stoppage, I thought. Having worked at CWA for a number of years, you find that in every contract. The only union I think may not have that is the West Coast Longshoremen, at least not 10 years ago when I was working with them, not for them. I believe they still had that right, but even though you have those clauses in contracts, in the last three, four decades, it's gone even further, I would offer, and that is both NLRB decisions and other court decisions pretty much suggest that even if you don't have those clauses, they are implied.
Yes, they are, because that's assumed to be common industrial practice.
Right.
And we know whose side the Supreme Court is on to begin with, and so that's what comes down. And I was very interested, Jack, that you said you had been most active in the 1970s, because I think one of the ways to look at this whole problem is to say we had a huge social upheaval in this country in the 1960s. Civil rights in the South, women's rights, etc., etc., etc. And you would have liked to believe that that would have had a, you know, an energizing impact on the labor movement. And my observation, you know, maybe we can put together your experience and mine. My observation is that so-called rank-and-file movements, since that very time, the 1970s, have been preoccupied with electing new top leaders to existing unions. Thus, the campaign in the National Miners Union to elect Arnold Miller, the campaign in the Steelworkers to elect Ed Sadlowski, the successful Teamsters campaign to elect Ron Carey, the activity to get John Sweeney and Richard Trumka as heads of the AFL-CIO. And my feeling is that whole strategy looked in the wrong direction, because as long as the new man, if you were lucky enough to succeed in your electoral campaign, as long as the new man was not trying to change these structural characteristics, and we mentioned some of them. We mentioned management prerogatives and no strike, but we could also mention the idea that the union is the exclusive bargaining representative, and particularly important, the idea that the union, once it's recognized by management, is able to tell any new employee that it has asked the company to deduct from the worker's periodic paycheck union dues, which the company then forwards to the union. And if there was more opportunity for the ordinary worker to, you know, to choose between different unions, et cetera, maybe the dues checkoff would be acceptable. But as I think you probably have experienced, once the union is locked in as representative, it becomes awfully difficult for the membership to change that. And so you have a situation where the union has an assured income from its membership with relatively little accountability, relatively little ability on the part of the membership to change the union that's representing them. And I know in Europe there's a completely different approach, where you may have many unions in the same workplace. My wife and I experienced an interesting variant of this in Nicaragua, Sandinista Nicaragua, in the 1980s, and they had, just as we do here, one union representing the entire workforce, but they also had an arrangement that whenever a contract expired, a new union could, if it wished, contest the ability to represent the membership, so that in effect the members had an opportunity to see Union A do its thing, go to the bargaining table, and if they didn't like what Union A did, then at the end of 3 or 4 or 5 years, however long the contract lasted, they had an opportunity to vote for Union B. That freedom is much, much, much more circumscribed here in the United States.
Well, I would agree with you once more. By the way, the cases that you cite of Kerry and Sadlowski and others, which I'm well aware of and supported to some extent in years past.
Yes, I did too, of course.
We've got that going on right now, a similar development with the Boeing workers. We have a movement to replace Buffenbarger, who has forced the Boeing workers to give up some of their pensions. And we've had the Boeing workers on the show talking about their situation and their elections coming up, their leadership elections coming up this month, in fact. And we'll probably have them on once again, but it's the same thing. Changing the top leaders, and usually these top leaders come from a staff position in the old regime.
That is true.
Because it's almost impossible for a rank and filer in a union with so many locals to get enough support of other locals to really run. Whereas the staff guy has some exposure, at least to a significant part of the locals. And in all these cases, you see these staff guys come up, and they come up with good intentions maybe even. But I would argue the way the whole legal system is now structured, it's almost impossible to have some significant change as long as this legal web, as I call it, I even wrote a song about it 10 years ago in my play.
Good for you.
The legal web. Having experienced it myself on three different occasions when I was in the labor movement to try to develop a true rank-and-file democratic militant local within this broader structure, there are so many tools now, and it is so biased on behalf of the leadership to quash any such local that's trying to act as if it were a militant rank-and-file democratic union.
And Jack, this is another thing I learned from John Sargent. He was president of an 18,000-member local union. I mean, that's quite a local union. And he told me, Staunton, we had situations where the entire bargaining committee of the local would turn a contract down. And the national union would just put it into effect anyway.
Yes, I know that experience myself, because the way the law works today, the labor law, and the way union constitutions exist, have changed over the last several decades, is that there really aren't any local unions anymore, in the sense of who owns the bargaining contract. In other words, the contract is owned by the national union,
and
not by the local union.
And it is the national union that is the contracting party, not the local.
That's right. That's right. So at any point, the national union can say to any, uppity local union, this is our contract. You can't have anything to do with it. You can't service it. You can't negotiate. You can't handle grievances based on it. And pretty much totally neutralize the local. The local is really, there really aren't any locals anymore. It's just one big local. And that's
when you
of,
take a look, as you suggest, Jack, at the grievance system, you may have excellent grievances coming up from the ranks, but at the second or third step of the procedure, it is a national union staff person who takes over handling of the grievance. And that means that if, let's say, I'm running the national union and you are the militant president of a local, and you've been giving me some problems, I may even be a little afraid you might run against me next time out. Well, tough luck, Jack, with your grievances. I don't know what happened to that. Well, yeah, we talked with our lawyers, and they said it was no good, so we dropped it without even consulting the guy who filed it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's a big pressure on local leaders to go along with the international on a whole host of other things, because if they don't, then they get cut off from arbitrations and from grievance handling, or In a severe case, the local totally gets cut off any support like we just described. It's our contract, national contract. So it's great pressure on a local leader to have to go along and get along with the international. And that's only one example of this whole web. I mean, there's not enough looking at what's happened internally within unions, union structure, and the support of that by the Labor Department and the law and the courts and so forth that make the position of the incumbent so powerful vis-a-vis any local and rank-and-file people. So it's almost impossible to build a democratic rank-and-file militant local union without at some point coming into a direct clash with the international, and they hold most of the cards, and they can really put you down. Even in a larger union, too, that, as you point, the 18,000, I mean, will the Chicago teachers be able to spread their more community-oriented view or approach to unionism today to the rest of the teachers' union without the international teachers' union coming in and pretty much preventing it? And the same thing going on with the IAM machinists and the Boeing workers today.
Yeah, and we have to remember that the international union reserves the power to put the local union in trusteeship.
That too,
and,
yes.
You know, if there's, I remember getting to know a steward for a union that John Sweeney, before he became president of the AFL-CIO, represented as president of the service employees. Well, this was a big union in Los Angeles, a big local union. And as everyone knows, in California, in the Los Angeles area, there's very heavy Hispanic immigration, and a lot of those people have a lot of experience with trade unionism in countries where you can get killed for joining to the labor movement. And in the big healthcare SEIU local in Los Angeles, this coalition of immigrant Hispanics and discontented Anglos elected a whole new executive committee of the local. Result? Sweeney, in one of his last acts before becoming president of the AFL-CIO, put this rebellious local in trusteeship, disallowed all those local union elections.
Oh, yeah, SEIU has a long history of that, and I can speak of it because I was an organizer in the SEIU years ago.
Oh, really?
As well as CWA, as well as a hotel and restaurant. And actually, I started out organizing for free just to get the experience with a good buddy of mine in the Steelworkers Union back in the early 70s.
What part of the country was that?
This was out in California.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this was a great guy, my mentor, and he was a staff guy, but he came out of Tennessee, and he had come up from the ranks in the 50s and in the 60s, a great fellow. We used to go hunting together and everything. Great fellow. And his first name was Sid. I'm not going to say his last name.
Okay.
He taught me actually, even before that, I, as a college student, came in contact at a conference with a steelworkers in another district back east. And I would then do their research, contract research for them, and they would take me out and teach me organizing. We used to go out twice a week in the evening on house calls. So I traded, my labor for them teaching me the old-fashioned way of organizing. And then when I came back to California with my buddy, we used to go out and organize places and so forth. In between hunting and fishing trips, so that's where I learned from the grassroots up, and then of course I became organizer for a couple, bounced around different unions, SEIU, HERE, and then settled in with CWA, became elected local president and contract negotiator and strike leader and so forth. But I know, I saw it when people were still willing to fight back in the early 70s and still could a little bit to some extent.
Yeah.
But boy, since in the last three decades, it's been downhill in terms of labor, as I can see it, and the strategy is totally off the wall. And I believe something fundamental needs to be done in terms of labor strategy, both political bargaining and so forth. And the question is that we've been touching on, Staunton, and I'd like you to comment more, is until we can change the structure, the way labor is organized, you know, right now it's these little stovepipes, you know, this is my union and we have contracts and so forth. It's all designed to inhibit rank-and-file activity to any significant extent. And until we can have a structure in the union movement, I believe, where rank-and-filers within the union and outside the union can have an organizational structure to express their militancy, I think, you know, it's continual slow grind to insignificance. Anyway,
well,
the point is...
I couldn't agree with you more. Go ahead.
What, in your view, needs to be changed? Because we could sit here all day and bellyache about the problems and give examples about the problems. And, you know, on my show, I have a lot of people come on, and we talk about a lot of issues, what's wrong. But I am fed up with listening to intellectuals who just talk about what's wrong and don't say, what are we going to do about it?
Okay, well, let me address that. As everyone knows, in the last 2-3 years, there has been a movement of low-wage workers in the United States. And this reflects the fact that so much manufacturing has moved out of the country, and what we have, maybe 50% of the existing workforce in the United States, is people working for Walmart and Starbucks and so forth and so on. And I regard this movement, as best I've been able to understand it, as, so to speak, getting us to second base. And when I say getting us to second base, what I mean is that instead of leading with the idea of, well, we want to become your exclusive representative in an NLRB election, unions like the food and commercial workers and the service employees appear to be approaching these low-wage service workers in industries that can't be moved out of the country and saying, we'll kick the can down the road so far as membership and representation is concerned, and right now we'll emphasize your immediate needs, and if it's getting a higher wage, we'll try to get a higher wage. If it's keeping the boss from paying you overtime, we'll try to take them to court, etc. And it seems to me that this is a very fruitful approach, but the problem is, and there have been 2-3 articles about this in recent months, that the service employees in particular just can't get away from the habit of running things from above.
Mm-hmm.
So that to a degree you have a rank and file strategy, but also to a significant degree you have the old pattern of top-down decision making. I think, however, that that is one promising beginning. And the other thing I'd like to mention is this. I edited a book of the experience of workers in the early 1930s, before you had a Wagner Act, before you had huge national unions, and the characteristic experience then at, you know, medium-sized industrial cities in the Midwest, for instance. Let's say you, Jack, work for one company, I work for another. But the way things worked was that there wasn't some big union. There wasn't an NLRB regional office. So if you hit the bricks, you let me know, and other workers in the same community would come out in support of you. And then next year, when it was my turn to strike, you would be on the picket line with me. And we had some of that in Youngstown. We had a group called the Workers' Solidarity Club, which we described as a parallel central labor union. And the idea was that it began after a couple of strikes where the official central labor body was awfully slow in providing any help. We tried to create an ad hoc entity such that whatever you needed, more people on the picket line, wood for the fire barrel, we would try to make it our business to reach out to other kinds of workers in this same area so that they could offer you help. And
What was the name of that book for listeners if they
called,
want it?
It's called We Are All Leaders. Because, you know, there were some famous occasions when IWW workers and others were confronted by the sheriff and the posse and so on. And like the company always does, the sheriff would say, well, who are your leaders? And the answer was, we're all leaders. Unfortunately, at Everett, Washington in 1916, the sheriff then opened fire.
You know, I think something like that, I've been thinking of that myself when I say some alternative local structures besides just central labor councils. I don't want to knock central labor councils, but we used to say, what are they good for? Cope, hope, and dope.
You go on strike in July, and snow is falling before you get any help.
They serve a purpose, but mostly what they serve today, they've atrophied, in my view, and what they serve today is to interview candidates for the Labor Party, for the Democratic Party. And there's not too much more that they do. I remember back in the 70s here in California, in Alameda Labor Council, we had a guy, Dick Grew, who was a feisty little guy and a real militant guy. And he would go out and participate and lead strikes and so forth. That's when, of course, Alameda used to be very industrial. Now all that industry has left. But he was probably the last vestige of a kind of activist labor council. I mean, not just in passing resolutions like
some labor councils,
but actually doing stuff, going out there and mobilizing and leading, organizing drives, and pulling in other unions and strike support and everything. And, you know, Dick Grew was a good guy. I knew him a little bit. But anyway, I think, you know, you're on to something here in terms of We Are All Leaders, this book. I'm going to go get that book and read that myself.
University of Illinois Press, 15 years ago.
Oh, only that long ago, huh? It might be in print.
It might
be. Okay. All right. And then, of course, your new book talks about rebuilding the labor movement from below, and I presume that probably follows, at least in part, in that tradition.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, I was a lawyer, I was a historian, I was an activist, and I tried as best I could to share with a reader how my own views developed. I mean, sometimes it was reading about the past, sometimes it was talking with a person who was trying to do something. A tremendous influence on me was when every steel mill in Youngstown shut down. And I asked the question, well, what do you do when your plant closes? And the answer is, to quote one of our local colleagues, you look into funeral arrangements, right? That is, what kind of a casket are you going to have? Or maybe you could pretend that it was foreign imports that caused the shutdown and get a little money under some act. But the idea of fighting it was, it just wasn't on the table because there were no weapons. And what we did with U.S. Steel, it was interesting because, as so often was my experience, it was workers themselves who suggested a possible way to go. And what they said in Youngstown, Ohio was, yeah, we have a national steel contract. And that national steel contract has a management prerogatives clause that gives the company all the power. However, here in Youngstown, we have a second contract with U.S. Steel because their superintendent in the valley said as long as they were making any profit at all, they would be kept open. And, you know, people made decisions. They bought homes, they sent their kids to expensive colleges, etc. And then the company reneged on it. And so we went to court on the theory that, the one contract gave them the authority, but there was a second contract here in Youngstown, and we lost, but we put up a hell of a fight. And as one of my friends said, Youngstown sure died hard.
Well, you know what? Let's return to this substantive theme here of what can be done on a local level, workers and in and out of the unions, to revitalize the union movement. And I do recognize that this low-wage worker movement is possibly an expression of that and extremely important. So is the immigrants' rights movement, I think.
Yes,
those
agree
are
with
workers.
You.
So we do have these real movements out there as a possibility for maybe building something new in terms of organization structure for the labor movement that would revitalize the labor movement. Because when I say, it's at a strategic impasse, I agree with you, this approach of negotiating contracts that are totally biased in favor of management and business and are more of a, in some ways, not totally, in some ways, a shackle on union workers today. And I don't want to overdo that. You know, I don't want to sound like I'm against contracts per se, absolutely, because I'm
and
not.
I agree with you, but let's have contracts without a no-strike clause.
Yeah, well, until you get movements until you can break through this legal web, you know, you're probably not going to get contracts without strike clauses. And then you still have the Supreme Court and court decisions
Jack,
that says
remember
you got
this,
no strike
as long,
anyway.
As long as you have Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, you have the right to engage in concerted activity for mutual aid or protection. And I understand that everybody in the world is trying to chip that right away from you, but you got it there in the law, unless you let your union give it away. And I really think that's the heart of the struggle. And that is why sometimes workers who are not in a union can get more done than workers who belong. And I'm agreeing with you, I'm not anti-union. But what I am saying is that workers have to hang on to their freedom of action. And by the way, one thing we learned in Youngstown was that if a group of working people have real ties to the community, and especially if the company is offering some kind of final consumer product, the power of the boycott, not by the union, but by community supporters, is enormous. And I'll give you an example. In Youngstown, we had a Buick sales and service place. And they were very snotty, and they wouldn't agree to anything, and the workers went on strike. Now, we also had, as most communities do, some very reactionary local judges. And in this particular strike, the local judge said, you can have two pickets, and that's all. And if a third person brought coffee to the two pickets, he could be in contempt of court. So we did a little thinking, and we invented something that came to be called a honkathon. This Buick sales and service place was on a main drag. So we would line up 20, 30, 40 cars, and we would drive very slowly down the main drag, just like any other citizens, wearing out the horns in our vehicles, displaying interesting signs, commenting on the character of the owner and so forth. And somehow the judge felt he didn't know what to do about it because, hey, we were just driving down the main street. What's wrong with that? And the company settled. And I think that that kind of I don't want to call it exactly improvised, let's say creative action, both by workers and their community supporters, is a good place to begin.
Well, I absolutely agree with you on that. And, you know, a couple comments. This past summer, the AFL-CIO threw up some balloons, feelers, to see what the reaction would be to this idea of bringing community organizations into the AFL-CIO at the top level and presumably then, you know, at levels below that. And it looked like there was some attempt to bring at least, you know, some relatively safe organizations like La Raza and NAACP and so forth on.
Yeah.
But that ran head-on into the building trades opposition, and in the AFL-CIO convention last September or August, it completely got shut down. So that attempt to forge a closer union community relationship, at least at the top, really went nowhere. But I believe, as you've described, that the key to labor's revitalization has to be some sort of more structured organizational form for workers in unions and workers outside of unions.
Yeah.
Forming an organization, because these ad hoc alliances come and go. And you need something more structured and ongoing where the best militants outside of labor and the best militants inside of labor can get together and be the outside of the union contract battering ram in these organizing drives and in these strikes and in boycotts and so forth. Because right now, if you're a worker within the union, the law is and the rules are so restrictive, both the union rules and the rules of the system, that you can't, as you pointed out, you can't do very much. But if you're outside the contract, outside the formal structure, you can do a hell of a lot more, as we see with the low-wage workers movement and immigrants' rights movements. So my view is I'm drifting towards something that says, okay, how can we revitalize not only labor community alliances, but revitalize something on a more permanent organizational basis where the best militants of both community and union can really get together outside the dominance of the contract and the dominance of their own formal union leadership. What do you think of that?
I think it's terrific. And as a matter of fact, I've, you know, spent a fair amount of energy thinking about the same thing, because there's an interesting book by two people called Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward, and it's called Poor People's Movements. And they look at the labor movement of the 30s, they look at the welfare rights movement, and so on. And they say that historically, just as a matter of fact, such movements achieve more before they are, you know, formally organized and buttoned down than they do afterwards. But that's a heck of a conclusion, because I think this is implicit in what you're saying. If we rely on periodic, spontaneous outbreaks and upsurges, we get clobbered in the long run by the other side, which is organized all the time through the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers and the people they elect to Congress and so on. And so the great task is to form some kind of network with the quality of permanence, just as you say, that doesn't give it all away in order to become permanent. Because we've just lived through that over and over again, it seems to me.
Well, I think that's an important phrase. Some sort of permanence network that doesn't give it away to become a permanent network.
Exactly. And, yeah. And if there are people listening to the two of us, I mean, what we're describing, this is not, manned flight to Mars. This is something ordinary working people know how to do. They sit in a circle in a room and they say, well, you're in this organization and you're in that local and let's do it together. And I think that if that could be more aggressively or clearly pushed, that that's the way to go.
Well, I would just comment on that to you and to the listeners. I wrote my first book back in 2006 called The War at Home, The Economic Class War in America. And the last chapter I dedicated towards exploring what some kind of a local structure would be. Outside the official union structure, and not a challenge to that union structure. I mean, mm-hmm. It wouldn't replace the labor councils. Let the labor councils continue to do their political interviews, cope and dope stuff. But let's have a structure of the best militants on a regional basis that would include union people and community people, that would have elected paid organizers, one from each, and it would be a parallel structure to be able to do those things that the law prevents the unions from doing now. Okay. Again, it's not in lieu of the original or existing structure, but that structure has become so hamstrung by decisions and laws and politics that it cannot really act in a militant way anymore. So let's set up something parallel
is more permanent. You're not going to believe this, but in Youngstown, that was the word we used. What is the Workers' Solidarity Club? It's a parallel central labor union. If the central labor union does what it was originally created to do, we don't need it.
Exactly.
But if we happen to have a central labor union, which, as you say, is bogged down in designating Democratic candidates and all of that, well, then we create a parallel.
And have you written about that, what that parallel structure might look like and act and, what its strategy and tactics might be? Have you written anywhere on that?
Well, I've tried to. In addition to the manuscript that I sent you, I have also written a book, and I'm bringing out a new edition of it, called Solidarity Unionism. And Solidarity Unionism is simply two words for what you and I have been talking about, and I describe our experiences in Youngstown. I describe what I've been able to learn as a historian, That's published by an outfit in Oakland called PM Press, and that should be out in a few months as well. So I'm firing all the artillery I've got, and it's really very encouraging to hear the similar conclusions that you've arrived at.
Well, one of the reasons we've been having this series on this show is to get people's experiences and views, seasoned people, you know, people who've been around, not intellectuals who have opinions, because opinions are, we used to say, you know what opinions are, everyone's got one, but people who have some experience to share, and some real people with real ideas who are in the real movement to share these ideas, because I think we've got to reach back to this generation, and that's the starting point to redefine where we go forward here. You know what I'd like to suggest, Staunton, here?
What's
I'd like
that?
To suggest that you come back, not next week, we got immigrants' rights folks coming on, but you come back the week after, and let's, you and I will gather my thoughts on this idea of solidarity unionism and labor community alliances in a permanent structured way, parallel to and not in conflict with the existing labor movement here. I'd like you to talk about solidarity unionism and in your view of that and the great task as we've described it today.
Well, I would love
to,
and
back?
If it's in 2 weeks, that's about as close as we can get to May Day, right?
That's right. That's right. Let's do that, because I think this, you know, we're getting down where the rubber meets the road. And as I've said, it's not just complaining about the situation, but saying, what are we going to do about it?
Yep.
And we need to really talk in nuts and bolts about where we go next step to do this, because we got some real movements out there, which means a real possibility.
Yeah,
but we can't let these movements just be single issue, and we can't let these movements just be ad hoc and impermanent. And we have to think the unthinkable in the union movement today, and that is, if what we got organizationally is not working for three decades at least now, well, you know, even damn business, if they're losing money and it's not working, they make changes. So we have to think that nothing is, as it exists now, is necessarily sacrosanct, and that we have to really make an effort for, and a change is difficult, particularly organizational change, but I believe organizational questions cannot be separated from strategic and tactical questions. They are
so
all interrelated.
Are we talking about 1 o'clock Eastern time on Saturday, May 3rd?
We are.
Okay. Well, I'm with you. I'm free.
Okay. And I'm going to hold you to discussing solidarity unionism in concrete, specific terms.
I'll do my best.
Gather my thought, go back to my old war at home, and pick that up and share my thoughts with you, and maybe together we can come up with 2 + 2 = 5. Who knows?
Okay. All right. Let's
All
do
right.
it.
All right. Staunton Lind, please do also tell us once again your forthcoming book, Doing History, Part 2, which is Reviving the Labor Movement from Below, comes out later this year. And also, Solidarity Unionism comes out in a couple of months, PM Press. Folks, let's take a look at that stuff. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll see you next week, and we'll be talking with people from the Revitalized Immigrants' Rights Movement that's going on right now. And then back in 2 weeks with Staunton. Talk to you later.
Okay.